We are in Nashville, Tennessee, at Vanderbilt University, in the Department of Psychology, with a professor of psychology, Isabelle Gautier. And we're going to talk about, primarily, initially at least, Perceptual Expertise, which is this handsome new book that you have co-edited with Mike Tarr and Daniel Bubb, Bridging Brain and Behavior. So, do you want to first of all tell me what, for the layperson, you mean by perceptual expertise and how it bridges brains and behavior?
That's a good question, because it needs to be distinguished from a number of things. When we talk about expertise, you think about the expert, the person who can do something very, very well. When we talk about perceptual expertise, we're talking about a skill that's different from semantic expertise, knowing a lot. We're talking about perceiving, right? So can you see a lot, which seems like a strange way to put it. But when you look at the world, you can see objects and faces and scenes in different ways, and you can extract different amounts of information from what you look at. So an expert is someone who's extracting a lot of information from what they see. So if they're looking, if I look at you, for example, I see a face, see a person. I don't need to get a lot of information to know that. Just the fact that there are two eyes above a nose is enough to know that there's a person in front of me. But to recognize you as a person, an individual person I've met before, that's harder. And that's starting to be in the realm of expertise. We're very good at face recognition. We say we're face experts, and we can be experts in many other domains. So that's what perceptual expertise is about. That makes sense.
Yes. Now, are we experts from the moment we're born? Do we have skills for doing things like you mentioned, like face recognition from the moment we're born, and how much, therefore, do we get better as we go over time?
Clearly, we have some skills the moment we're born. The skills we're interested in when we study perceptual expertise are typically skills that take quite a bit of time to develop. So, a newborn will be able to look at a face and get something out of it. They may, there's evidence that they may even show a preference for looking at faces compared to other stimuli. It's not always, scientists are trying to figure out why that is. But that's, again, that's very different to know that there is a face there and maybe have a preference for looking at the face compared to the skills you need to encode this individual face and be able to recognize it. Again, there's a lot that we acquire over development, and there's a lot that we can still learn as adults in the realm of perceptual expertise.
How do you go about testing this and doing experiments? What kind of experiments do you use, and what kind of equipment do you use?
We look at expertise in many different ways. We both look at people who are experts already, and we bring them in and we compare them to others who are not. So we might do this in different domains. We might look at experts, people who are car experts. People are really good at recognizing, a car, even looking in the mirror, looking at the headlights from, very far away, and they know right away what car it is. We study these people and compare them to me, for example, who can't do much with a lot of information from an image. So we look at birders, we look at people who are experts at musical notation. So those real-world experts are really useful to show us what the large differences that you may get when you compare experts and novices. Another approach, though, is to train people in the lab in developing some of these new skills that we can see in the real world, but at a smaller scale. So we may develop novel objects, computer-generated objects, and train people to recognize them in different ways, to categorize them so that we can track the changes as they acquire these skills. So we do both of these things because they really afford, they give us different sorts of information. And we have a lot more control when we train people in the lab and we know exactly what it is that they were exposed to. And we can also track the changes, you know, let's say in their brain using brain imaging, we can track the changes as they occur. Whereas if you show up in my lab and you're a car expert, you know, I can only quiz you about how you trained, and I can only compare your brain to the brain of a novice. So we use both methods.
So you use these things called greebles as well, right? Which is on the cover of the book and also inside the book. Yes. They look like sort of little Yoda figures.
Yes, yes, people have said that.
So I assume that the thinking here was, if you're showing anything that people might have even the slightest prior knowledge of, then they're already, in a sense, tainted in terms of knowing what. So this is a kind of a fresh, completely fresh target for them to start training on.
Yeah, the greebles were...
How did they come up? What's the story there?
Well, the story is when I was a graduate student, a first-year graduate student, thinking about what I was going to do for my dissertation, we had a research assistant in Michael Tarr's lab. His name is Scott Hugh, and he was quite talented. It was a talented artist, but he also... Mike had just given him some brand-new software that we had gone, you know, that... allowed you to create computer-generated stimuli. And this was fairly new at the time. People were using more simple images and said, well, Isabel will tell you what she needs and try to figure it out. And so what I told Scott at the time is we wanted novel objects, things that people hadn't seen before, that would have a small number of parts in the same configuration so that they were, in a sense, like faces, because all faces have two eyes and a nose and a mouth. But each face is unique in the specific shape of the part. So, you know, each eye and each nose is a little bit different, but fairly similar from one face to another. And the general configuration is similar, but the subtle relationships between the parts change. So we wanted to recreate that situation in a new domain. And Scott came up with these objects, and, you know, we looked at them and said, well, they look funny, but they meet all the criteria. And so we went with them. And then this famous professor of psychology at Yale saw them as I was making copies in the mailroom of my stimuli and said, oh, they're funny little greebles. This is Robert Abelson. And we just said, well, I guess we're going to call them greebles. And they've been used for a long time. We still use different versions of them in different experiments. But we use similar, you know, other sets like them. I mean, what's important about the greebles is not what they look like specifically, but that we were able to demonstrate that you can train people to expertise within 7 hours of training. And at the time, people had done, you know, expertise studies with dog show judges, so people who have been looking at dogs for 10 years. And they were saying, oh, maybe when you're an expert, you know, in 10 years, maybe you can acquire some of the behaviors that are thought to be specific for faces. But it takes a long time. And, oh, 10 years, that's like, you know, a child, when they're 10 years old, maybe their face perception is somewhat like what you see in an adult. So that was the model. And what we were able to demonstrate with the Griebel studies is that in 7 hours of training in the lab, we could recreate, you know, maybe not the same magnitude of expertise that you see in the real world for faces or other things, but something that was a really good model and a very useful model, because if you can do that, then, you know, there's a lot of studies that you can do to track the kind of learning that occurs during the acquisition of perceptual expertise. So that's really what's important about the Griebels, is what what it allowed us to do after we had that first finding, which led to the creation of this group. You know, many people were excited about that we could do these studies.
This is one of the points that came up in the discussion I've been having with people from the law school here as well, in things like the capacity of judges to improve their ability to make discriminative judgments about people.
Yeah.
And the fact that we... that we have this sort of folk intuition about whether we trust somebody or not. In fact, there's probably a great deal of computation going on that there obviously is a great deal of computation going on that we're not aware of, and there's all sorts of comparisons being made and so on and so forth. But we have this intuitive sense, people have this sense that they do this, that they acquire this skill as a result of experience, and you know, like the dog handlers and the dog judges and so on. And that if you came up with something that allowed somebody to learn that to the same level very quickly, it would somehow devalue the other one. Do you know what I'm talking about here?
I do. It's interesting. I mean, I guess I should qualify what I said. I'm not saying that the Griebel experts were as good, you know, as good experts as maybe someone who's been training with dogs or someone who would train with Griebels for 10 years. There may be. There could be. I mean, we haven't really studied that at that level, but there might be an important difference between training for a couple of weeks and training for years. You know, the problem is if you want to take these things in the lab and learn about the small changes that are leading to the acquisition of expertise, you need to be able to do a study in a time span that, you know, that's meaningful, where you can, you know, track brain activity and behaviors. And, you know, 10 years is a long time to do that. So it's an interesting question whether you get the same expert, you know, if you train them quickly and you get a good performance, whether you might get a better expert for all we know. Because a lot of work, you know, on expertise, I think, suggests that there's an illusion of expertise, that that when you're recognized as an expert and you've been making decisions for a long time, that you're paid a lot of money for these decisions, and you know, that's all very rewarding and reinforcing that you're making the right decisions. But in a lot of fields, you don't actually get the feedback telling you whether the decision was the right decision or not. You know, in the lab, when a subject looks at a stimulus, makes a decision, we say correct, incorrect, and they learn from that. And you know, there are theories of learning that really have to do with that, the importance of the timing of that reward signal and systems in the brain that depend on that. So if you're in an environment where you make, a medical, you know, judgment about a scan that you're looking at, and you say, well, it's likely to be this, and then this is being used by other people in the process, and you never get back the information, or you get it, you know, later, you get it maybe weeks later, regarding whether this was the right decision or not. It's not clear that that's the perfect situation, or that's even a very useful situation to tune your perceptual and other learning systems. So, you know, there's a real challenge there, training experts in the real world, because feedback is very important.
And it's missing from the example I was giving you, in the sense that there's a sense in which the most valued currency is the duration of time spent at the job.
Right.
You know, and that, therefore that must have conveyed something like wisdom, whatever that word means, on the person who's been there all that time.
Right.
I was just genuinely inquiring, do you think that you could have systems, whether people would actually go for it or not, where you could get that kind of really cranked up level of expertise because you had a very sophisticated system with great feedback and you were doing it at a rapid rate of knots?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how difficult it would be to have people buy into it, but certainly the work that we do on perceptual expertise suggests that just time, just exposure, let's say, with objects doesn't do much. Just familiarity with objects is not enough. So, you know, we see a lot of cars, all of us, in the sort of world we live in now. I see a lot of cars. I'm not a car expert. I don't look at cars with the intent to make the sort of judgments that car experts do. And so I don't acquire expertise. I mean, even if I can keep looking at cars for the rest of my life, that won't get me much closer to the kind of perceptual expertise that we see in the lab or that we can train in a few hours.
Okay, so now this is about the PEN,
Perceptual Expertise Network.
And it says in your introduction here that it's based on the motivation behind it, which is a response to a challenge posed by the MacDonald Foundation.
That's
initially.
Right.
It's based on two principles. First, to do science guided by a question-driven framework rather than one motivated by techniques. In other words, Penn members do not ask themselves what should be the next fMRI or ERP experiment just because those happen to be the techniques with which they're most familiar, which they've invested in their lab resources in.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they brainstorm, capitalize on the diversity of the group to select the tool or tools that best suit the particular question. So that's very much, the fact that we've got a bright new shiny object here called an fMRI scanner.
Right.
Doesn't mean that we have to change. The question is, what is the information that we seek to get, and will this thing be have great utility in finding the answer?
Right. No, that's exactly right, and that's been very, very important to this group. It's certainly been really important for myself when we started this group. This was the motivation. It was the fact that, you know, each of us may devote a lot of time, and we have to, in cognitive neuroscience, you know, to learning a technique. It's hard. So as a grad student, you may get really good at one, very familiar and comfortable one or two methods. But you also are exposed to a lot of other things, and the questions that come up sometimes aren't well suited to these techniques. And, you know, I think we need scientists who are more technique oriented. I think it's very important that there are people who think about the limitations of the methods and what it is that we can do with these techniques mm-hmm. that we're developing. But I think we also need people who say, well, wait, step back, given what we know, what's the most interesting question? And then, given the question, what tool or set of tools do we need? And in order to do that, you need to have collaborators. Now, in cognitive neuroscience, almost everybody collaborates. It's a very collaborative field. What we have in Penn is a bit different, though, because for most collaborations in psychology or cognitive neuroscience or neuroscience, what you have is, first you have a project, and then people say, oh, I'd like to do this, and I'm going to find the right collaborators. I need an ERP person because I do fMRI, and we really need both. So you look around, maybe in your department, maybe your connections, and you set up the right team for the project, right? That's fairly standard. What we have in Penn is we said, we're pretty sure this group of people is going to have a lot of things in common, a lot of questions they're interested in. So we're going to work together for a long time. We're going to brainstorm together about the questions. So it's not like we start from the questions and then create the right team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been working for almost 10 years together now and just coming up with lots of questions and then saying, okay, well, let's look around, see, you know, who among us is the best group of people to do this. And we've done this so much now, it's kind of second nature. So our students are trained in this framework. So I think that's the difference, is it's not motivated by a specific research question. It's motivated by a general kind of interest in some, you know, we know that we overlap in what we're interested in, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, you say, I mean, where did the idea for the collaboration come from? You say that, for example, in cognitive neuroscience, people collaborate all the time. Well, they do now, but only 2 decades ago, perhaps, those were almost separate disciplines. I mean, we've just celebrated in San Diego the Institute for Neural Computation's 20th anniversary, roughly. That was the beginning of the Department of Cognitive Neuroscience as well, roughly the same, a little bit earlier. But these were separate silos once upon a time. So collaboration is still not exactly, although I think interdisciplinary work is hugely important, it's still not necessarily the...
Well, collaboration is difficult.
The routine.
Collaboration is difficult. It's difficult across, you know, disciplines, as you're saying, because we don't speak the same language. And it's difficult just to collaborate with people you don't know very well, that you have to learn to trust as you go, or people who simply have different assumptions about how a collaboration should be set up. Mm-hmm. So I think there are always going to be challenges for collaborations. And in a sense, that's what a network like Penn can provide is an environment where you have a community of collaborators that, you know, trust each other and have acquired a common jargon, and all that work is done. When you have that idea for a project, you know, all that difficult stuff that you have to do when you set up a new collaboration, that's already taken care of, and you can already move to the next step. So, you know, I think you're right. I think collaborations are still a challenge, but the field requires it. But we may need more of these small collaborative communities if we want to facilitate it, or at least train our students to be better at it, because it's definitely a skill. It's a skill that's different from all the other things they learn in graduate school, and that's, you know, yeah, that's a challenge.
In general, science can be pretty competitive as well. I mean,
absolutely.
So
let
me ask you something about this in terms of the kind of the model that you have of the mind, which must be the sort of the foundation upon which you think you're building your experimental work and so on. So there's some sense that you have of what you're working with. So, and it says here on your website, one issue that's of particular interest is how the visual system organizes itself in what appears to be category-specific modules. For instance, face recognition is often given as an example of a highly specialized module that may function independently from general object recognition mechanisms. However, faces are amongst the most visually similar objects that we need to recognize individually. Most of us acquire a large amount of expertise in doing so throughout our lives. So, can we unpack some of these words here, like category-specific modules and face modules? There is a school of thought, for example, which would argue, and this would be associated with Nancy Kamwisher, that there's a fusiform face area which is specialized for faces.
Yeah, well, there's no question there's a fusiform face area. I think in cognitive neuroscience there's been so much work looking at this area that you can't question the fact that we can see this. That is, if you put someone in the scanner and you show them faces and you show them objects almost regardless of what you ask them to do. Yeah, but typically you ask them to do a fairly simple task looking at these objects and you compare the brain activity, you're going to get a network of areas that are more active for faces than objects, but the most active area is going to be in this part of the occipital ventral cortex and really the floor of mm-hmm. the temporal lobe. And the fusiform gyrus, and so it's there. And I certainly don't question that. What I'm really interested in is how it got there and what it's doing. And what it tells us about the rest of the visual system and maybe how we should approach other situations like this where we see something that looks like a very specialized little place in the brain for something. You know, how should we think about that? How do we approach this problem of understanding the function of this area? For faces, you know, there's quite a bit of debate because it could be innate. It could be something that we have evolved, you know, a tool that we have evolved because we need it. We need it as social animals, and face recognition is so important to our survival that we have the specialized area just for faces. But there are other domains where you see specialization in the visual system. You see it for words, for letters. You see it, we've seen it recently for musical notation. We know that we haven't evolved. You know, there hasn't been enough time to evolve a category-specific module, a little specialized system just for words or for musical notation, let's say. So obviously you can learn these things. You can acquire them, right? And there's not as much debate as to the origins of these other areas because we know they have to be learned. You know, in the case of faces, it's an interesting question whether it is learned or not. I think it is, but it's hard to demonstrate with complete certainty that this little area is not different from all the other little systems that are specialized that we see that we know have to be, those are learned. But hey, maybe this one, you know, it's been learned a long time ago, and then we've, you know, it was so important for our survival that it's built in now. So it's possible, and there's lots of debate on it.
Well, but as I was saying, there are, especially in the discussions with the, say, the judges, the people in the law schools, mm-hmm. who were now getting information that's much more informed by neuroscience. Again,
right.
What kind of a model are you using? And if your model is one that presupposes that the mind is massively modular, with a great number of very specialized areas, cognitive domains that are reliably developing, that are in the genome even, then that's a different kind of person you have in front of you in the dock than somebody than a model in which almost all of the development has been almost all of the construction of the neural architecture has been during development.
No.
And you then say, well, so this person's, they made their own life. Or on the other hand, you could say, well, he's got a damaged...
Yeah, I guess there are issues in terms of how they got to be who they are.
Yeah.
So maybe they were born like this, but maybe experience made them. Well, and then there's also a question of whether they could change, right?
Playing the answer somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Who knows?
No, it is really important, and I agree. But I think we have to accept the fact that it doesn't have to be all or none.
No.
That the fact that we see a lot, I mean, that's the challenge, right? There's no question that we see expertise effects in the visual system. As I said, we see them for domains like words or musical notation. But you know, when we test car experts and compare them to novices, we'll see activation in there, in the fusiform gyrus, overlapping with facial activity. In fact, at the resolution we're looking at it, it's the same area. Now, fMRI is not, it's not the level of the single neuron. It may not be the same exact cells, you know, recognizing faces and supporting the recognition of cars or greebles or some other. But it's really, really close. And so you have to ask yourself, well, what does it tell us about face recognition that you can learn something new and it doesn't go, you know, some other place fairly far in the visual system? It goes right here. Does it suggest that that's just why you have a face area, that in your development you've trained a lot with faces, so it went to this place, and when you solve a similar problem with a different kind of object, it goes to the same area? Or is it completely irrelevant? I mean, to me, it's very, very difficult to accept the fact that it says nothing about the function of the face area.
I mean, often in these sorts of studies, the solution comes by observing people with deficits, in other words, an area that's been knocked out or is no longer... What's the evidence on that? Are there areas, are there quite clearly defined, absolutely clearly distinct territories that if you remove them, you lose your capacity to see faces and so
right.
on.
No, it's a fascinating area of study. First of all, because you find these very rare patients who will have a selective impairment in face recognition. So we call that prosopagnosia. Yeah. Or, there's at least one case, very, very rare, but one good documented case of a patient who can only recognize faces, has lost the ability to recognize other objects, but does really well with faces. So you seem to have a double dissociation here, yeah. right? And, you know, in some fields, it's been, you know, double dissociations have been quite important in the history of neuropsychology. When you build a model where if you see a double dissociation, it's good evidence that you have a specialized system just for one thing. But the problem is you can challenge this logic using computational models, for example, where you know that you have not put in a specialized system because you build a model. And then you can break the model many, many times, run a lot of simulations, so you basically create a lot of patients. And then you look at the distribution of this, and what you see is that sometimes, rarely, you'll get these extreme cases that have a specific deficit in one domain or another. And you can get them out of a model where there's not a specialized system. So this tells us that perhaps what we see in the population, these very rare deficits that are, you know, opposed to each other, they could just be the statistical flukes that we've become obsessed about, right? I think neuropsychology has taught us a lot, and it's very important in order to understand the organization of visual system. In terms of understanding the origins of the specialization, so why we have a face area, I'm not sure the answer is going to come from that field, because we know there's a system there that's fairly specialized. We can see it in the brain of normal individuals. So it makes quite a bit of sense that at that point, once it's there, you know, if you're really unlucky and you get a stroke in exactly the right spot, you might lose that skill. Mm. But it doesn't tell you how it got there. You know,
You mentioned music, mm-hmm. Which is something we're obviously very interested in. A temporal dynamics of learning center music is a hugely important exemplar of the importance of timing. And you've got some new work coming out with Yetta Wong as well. Could you tell me a little bit about this? A multimodal neural network recruited by expertise with musical notation.
And we're quite excited about this because we're looking at music from a different perspective. You know, I think there's been quite a bit of interest recently in music, and there should be. It's a fascinating area to look at learning in the brain. But a lot of it has to do with, you know, music, hearing it, playing it, you know, performance, so motor and also visual motor coordination and clearly the auditory system. What we asked really is a question about visual perception here. We were interested in whether learning to read music changes or specializes your visual system in any way, in the same way that we have learned from experiments that reading seems to do so. So, and whether it would be the same area, you know. So would you use the same parts of your brain that are specialized for words? Would you use those to read musical notation, for example? So we really, you know, we did an experiment where we did something incredibly simple, which probably, you know, shouldn't have worked, but it did. We simply put people in the scanner where either an expert musician, so someone who could read music, musical notation, someone who could not, and we showed them on the screen a single little note on the staff, but the task was not to read the note. The task was to detect a little gap in the staff, so a novice can do that. And then we compared the brain activity during this task with the same task detecting the little gap on the staff when there's maybe a mat symbol there. So everybody can see the mat symbols in the same way. All of our subjects had the same sort of experience with these control stimuli. And so what we saw was only in the brain of people who can read music, and only for the notes, a whole network of areas in the visual system, in the auditory system, in the motor cortex, that were more active, triggered automatically by the presentation of the stimulus. It's not, you don't have to read music in this task, but it seems to reactivate the whole network that a musician needs when, you know, he or she is learning to hear, play, you know, perform the music. So there's a lot that's going on when you become a musician, but these things are so integrated and can be automatically triggered. We were really surprised in that. So we were looking for something in the visual system. We got that. And it's a different area than you get for words. But we got a lot more. We really saw this large network. And, you know, if I can add one more thing, when we looked at the activity in these brain areas, even outside of the visual system, we could use the amount of activity in each person and predict how rapidly they could perceive musical notation in the lab. Okay? So it really seems to be a real important connection between the activity in the motor or auditory system and your ability to visually perceive these stimuli rapidly, to encode them very rapidly, which is important when you read music, when you play, when you're going to perform. But you might expect this to happen in the visual system. But it's these individual differences are, found all over the brain. So there's a lot, this was the first study asking a very novel question, and there's really a lot to learn from this domain.
So just one little point I just want to go over again. When you said at the beginning, these were not intact musical notes then? Did you say there was a gap?
There's a gap. So there's the staff, the five lines and note, and there's a little gap right here. That's just a gap, just a break in the line on the staff. The note is there, just a single note, and the task does not even require you to look at the note. So it's a very, very simple task, and that's something we do a lot when we bring experts in the scanner, is we like to give experts tasks that are really simple, something that even a novice can do, because we're going to compare their brain activity to a novice, and if we give them a task that is really hard, of course they're going to do a lot better than the novices. And then when we look at the results, we're going to have a problem interpreting this, because it could be that any difference that we get between the experts and the novices is due to the expert doing better, right? So you would expect a lot of differences from that. So we don't want to look at expertise in that way. When we bring them in the lab, in the building, and we are doing behavioral experiments, and we measure their reaction time, their accuracy, there we want to give them tasks where they can demonstrate how much expertise they have. But when we're looking at brain activity, it's important to look at novices and experts kind of on the same footing.
Okay. At the risk of I'm looking now at this thing, and I see now that what you mean, there's a gap in one of the lines.
Just a little break in the line.
Yes.
But what I'm still, and I may be retarded here, I'm still don't quite understand why that needs to be there.
That's a good question. It needs to be there because we could just ask people to look at these stimuli and do nothing, right? Just look at them. And that would be an easy task. That would be such an easy task. And in fact, some of our subjects might fall asleep. Some of our subjects might start daydreaming and think about other things. Right. So and it's been shown many, many times that if you force people to pay attention to a stimulus through a task, so we have an image there, you want people to pay some attention to it, you're going to get better brain signals, better activity that you can detect with fMRI. So this is a bogus task. This is a task that everyone can do to the same level that keeps them from trying to read the musical notation in any way. I mean, if we had asked them to make a judgment about the notes, the experts would have done a lot better than the novices.
So you ask them to spot the gap then.
That's it. That's all we're asking them to do. So we could have done a number of things. We could have had these notes in slightly different colors and they would be doing a color judgment. The important thing is it's kind of a cover-up kind of background, a task that's orthogonal, that has nothing to do with what we're interested in, that everybody can do.
But it nevertheless made music areas go wild.
But, well, it's not the task. The task is there for everybody, and everybody can do it well. What seems to make the whole network go wild is the presence of these notes that the experts have such associations with. Yeah.
So this is rather like in a conversation I was having with Tom Palmieri earlier, that he was describing the expertise, the acquisition of expertise with his son when he goes birding,
for example. That's right.
And the enormous richness that an experienced person sees that is just way beyond what the naive viewer sees.
Yeah, I think,
is there a parallel there somewhat?
No, there is. And I think the something that's very important for me, for people to understand, is that we're all experts at something. I think when we say we study expertise, it sounds like you're studying the rare few out there. But that's not the case at all. I mean, we all have perceptual expertise in many domains. So, face recognition, reading are domains that most of us are really good at. Mm. Not all of us, and we vary. But then in our work, in our hobbies, things like bird watching, we develop these expertise. And it becomes really important to what you are. So when you're thinking about a person, what defines them, you tend to get into these areas really quickly. That, you know, so if you talk to anyone about what they love, it might be food, shoes, it might be birds, cars, it might be antiques, art, you know, but many of these domains present challenges to the visual system. And it's something that often makes it difficult for the novice and the expert to talk, and because they're not seeing the same thing. In fact, experts, in our hands, experts are very bad at describing how they do what they do, perceptual experts. Now, when a novice starting to learn a difficult task, oh, they can say a lot. You know, they can say, oh, well, I'm trying to pay attention to this little part. I think that this will help me. I have this strategy. But by the time we've trained them, or by the time we get someone in the lab who's really good at something, they're like, well, I see it. Like, don't you see it? Of course there's a difference. I had a really good example of this the other day. My friend Joanne here, who's a faculty, is going to get a new puppy. And she's into this breed of dogs, water dogs, Portuguese water dogs. And so she was looking at pictures of the litter.
Like Obama's dog, right?
Yeah, yes. She did it first, though. And she got a picture of these, I don't know, five or six possible puppies she could get. And she was, you know, so we were looking at them. Aren't they cute? And I could say, yes, they're cute. And then they all had different color, you know, collars. And she was saying, I hope I get the blue one. And then, you know, we got into discussion where she was trying to explain to me what was special about the blue one. She hadn't met these dogs, but she knows a lot about these dogs. You know, she goes to dog shows and her dogs are in competition. And she could see features already in that dog that were promising of something that he could be or could do. She really preferred that one already. And she could, you know, develop an attachment to this image in a way that, to me, they were all little cute puppies. They looked identical. Right. So that was a very good example of what, you know, there's a perceptual expertise there. There's something just being able to tell that these dogs are different. But it demonstrates the depth of what you can do once you're a perceptual expert. I mean, this comes up all the time in other race effects with faces. Right. If you look at faces of another race and these people mostly look all the same to you, well, there's a lot that you can't do thinking about them that you can do when you think of people as individuals. So it really, you know, there's more there that I don't study in my work, but that there's an important influence of perceptual expertise on the rest of what you do with objects.
I remember being at Caltech, in a lecture room at Caltech, and the lecturer put up a slide, and it had about 36 monkey faces. I think they were macaques, rhesus macaques. And she said, how many of you can spot the differences here and see the differences? And of course, it's just, they're all the same.
You can't. No, I do this in class too.
And she said, of course, that their keeper knows them all very well. Incidentally, that lecturer was Justine Sergent, who worked on face. Some of her work was
in Montreal.
In the face area, and she also wrote a very good paper and a very early paper on the musical brain.
That's right.
So. Yeah, no, her work is very foundational in this area. But yeah, you're right. I mean, that's a good. I mean, in a way, you could say, well, that's a good demonstration, right? You're showing the novice the limit, right? Mm-hmm. So they look at this and they can't see. But the problem is that you're still not showing them what they're missing. I mean, the novice. Looking at this, I mean, you can tell them, oh, to the expert, these monkey faces, or, you know, they're as different as people around you that you know, but I can believe that or not, right? That's a statement, and that's where you get into these discussions with people saying, oh, well, you know, faces of people of that race, I think they're really more similar. And like, well, I understand why you say that, because you don't see the differences. I mean, I think one of the best demonstrations really has to do with inversion of faces. So you take upright faces, with which we're experts. And so you may have, you know, 15 different faces that are obviously very distinct. You turn all of this upside down, and if there are not large differences in the hair or you know, maybe something clear like a mustache or these faces clearly suddenly become very much more homogeneous. They all look alike more. And we're a lot better, it's been demonstrated many times, that we're a lot better at individuating faces upright and inverted. And we may do it using different strategies. So that's a good demonstration that there's something you can see. And look, it's the same image, but now you can't see it anymore, right?
So now you've this latest paper I'm looking at in Psychological Science, a recent paper in Psychological Science, anyway, you've changed from greebles to ziggurins.
That's right.
Again, these are kind of non-primate, if you want.
They're novel objects. Yeah.
And the idea is what? To sort of see how easily people acquire expertise in recognizing them?
The idea is to go one step further compared to the Griebel studies. So in the Griebel studies, what we had done was say, you know, we asked, can we get with expertise, with these non-face objects, something that looks like face expertise? So can we get behaviors or brain activity in a Griebel expert, you know, with training? And we showed that we could. What we don't know is how we got that. So there are many things that happen in this very short 7 hours of training with Griebels, right? First of all, they see a lot of objects, and they learn things about them. They practice different tasks. And so what if this is important? Maybe it's just that we expose them with these objects that lead to this. We don't know that. So what we wanted to do here is really compare two different kinds of experience with the same objects, train two different kinds of experts. So there's not just expertise, right? I mean, as we've been talking, we've been calling many different things expertise. We've been calling face recognition and reading expertise. Now, they're similar in the sense that you start with these challenges. They're very hard to start with. You have to practice and you get good at them. But what you get good at is very different in these two areas. So with faces, you take objects that share a configuration and you learn to individuate them. With letters, just take letter recognition. Well, that's not what you do. It's not like I want to recognize every little A that I've seen today as an individual, right? And I've seen A's today in all sorts of sizes and fonts and I don't care, right? I just want to know it's an A. So in a sense, I'm doing the opposite. I'm taking all of these objects that are subtly different, but I'm ignoring these differences and saying they're all the same, right? So that's part of what I'm doing, but I'm really, really good at it. So we created these objects, and we wanted them to be fairly neutral. You know, the Griebels, for example, look like little creatures, and some people have said, well, they're too face-like. That's why you get these effects. So we said, okay, well, let's try something else, right? I mean, we've gotten these expertise effects now with so many things, like car experts and so on. We don't think that the geometry matters. We think that experience matters. But let's demonstrate that. So we create these objects, and then we took two groups of subjects now. That's the important difference between the Ziggurin studies and the Griebel studies. We have two groups. One group is trained to do what the Griebel experts were doing, which is individuate these objects. They learn individual names for these objects, and they get really good at recognizing them as individuals. But the other group of subjects, for them, we set up a training experience that is a bit more like what we do with letters. It's not reading. So they're not mapping sounds onto groups of characters and so on. They're doing something more like letter recognition. They're doing it very fast in arrays of Ziggurins. But they're not learning to individuate them. They're learning to ignore a lot of the subtle differences between them and categorize them in the way that we would say a lot of different things are A's or a lot of different things are B's. So we gave them the same amount of experience with these objects, but in with different sorts of tasks. And we tracked their the behavioral changes, and then in a follow-up study, we also tracked brain activity changes. And we got very important differences. So behaviorally, what we found, to just tell us a simple story, is a short story, is that when you learn to individuate Ziggurats, you learn to treat them holistically as a whole. It becomes very difficult to pay attention to a small part of these objects. You know, even if you tell subjects, just pay attention to this little part because maybe we'll change something. What we can show is if we change another part of the object, it influences their judgment. They're really processing the whole object. Whereas mm-hmm. people who have had the same amount of experience with these objects, but a different kind of experience, so in the letter-like training group, they do not acquire holistic expertise. So that's a behavioral difference that suggests that you can train people, and both of these groups of people get faster and better at what they're trained at. But in terms of the perceptual strategies they acquire, those are different. And in the brain, we obtain different results too. So just suggesting that it's not what you're looking at, it's what you learned about it, what you learned to do with the objects.
All right, so all of this fun with Griebels and Ziggurats and so on, what's the translational value of it? I mean, it doesn't have to have, it could be just for fun, but I mean, how does it, since we're talking about the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center and the science of educating, I assume it goes back into the system somehow, or you have some advice and some suggestions about how that can improve the educational experience.
I mean, clearly, what we demonstrate in these studies is how quickly you can change the way that you see things. Yeah. You know, fundamentally, your brain becomes set up in one way. If this happens in a few hours of training, in fact, we have studies now showing that in 45 minutes of practice, you already start to get in these different trajectories, and you're going to see things in this way or that way. So I think one of the lessons is that you should be very deliberate about thinking about the way you present, in this case, visual information. I think it applies to all of perception. But, you know, that as you teach people, children, adults, you know, different things, anything that you teach them, really, and there's some kind of visual support. So when you learn music, right? Well, there are lots of skills you're learning. There's also this musical notation that you need to learn, and you do. Well, it may be useful to think about the order in which you present things and the task that you give people very early on, because you're changing the way they see these things. There's information that they're going to be able to process faster. There are things that they are or are not going to be able to ignore. And you may say, well, eventually they'll learn it, so it doesn't really matter. But you could end up with a much better, you know, thinker about a domain and an area by changing the way they see some of the objects that they're looking at in a domain. And this applies to many, many domains, like medical training, for example. Mm. Right. So I think there's a lot of translational potential. There's not a lot of research, like the sort of thing that we're starting to do now, where we're looking not at just kind of gross coarse evidence that if you practice, you get better. We know that. Everybody knows that. That's kind of boring. You know, what we're interested in is exactly how do you get better? Exactly how do you start to change the way you perceive these objects and why? You know, what sorts of knobs can you change in the training experience that will influence these perceptual strategies? And so that's what brings me to work every morning. There are so many little knobs to turn in these training studies. And if we present objects bigger, does it matter? Smaller? We started, you know, with my students the other day, we're like, we're not getting the effect we were seeing the other time, but wait, our objects are larger. Does that matter? We don't know that. There's such little work where things are changed during the process of the acquisition of learning that we don't know.
It's so odd, isn't it? You'd have thought that, advertising companies mm-hmm. would have already been all over this. You know, how can we best facilitate people becoming more familiar with our product?
There's an emotional component that comes with expertise that is, you know, something that, again, it's not the question that I ask, but I always, it comes back all the time in many, many domains, because perceptual fluency leads to that. If something is easy, if you can see differences that other people have to work really hard to get, that leads to a, you know, to a warm and fuzzy feeling. And so we don't have trouble. We don't lose people in the lab when we train them. You think, oh, these studies are long and they're, you know, pretty hard at first. But as people get good at this, they're like, oh, I like this. Of course they do. Something that was hard is becoming easier. And so fluency leads to a bit of an emotional attachment that I guess could be useful in many different domains. So,
all right. So this is an important concept to me, anyway. This notion of perceptual fluency. I mean, so we were at a meeting recently, talking about what could possibly be done to stimulate more innovation in education. Mm-hmm. And as exemplars of how the media currently viewed the situation, I had some magazine covers with me, and they're very recent ones. Newsweek basically said, you know, had a cover that was saying fire bad teachers, get rid of bad teachers.
Right.
New York Times magazine had an entire cover story about how to build a better teacher. Mm-hmm. And there was an issue of The Atlantic that was about creating, you know, what characterizes great teachers and so on. All about teachers and how to build a better teacher. And I wonder if the question, or certainly one aspect to address, is how to build a better learner. And I'm not talking about genetic engineering, I'm just saying what skills, and you're talking about perceptual fluency there, maybe perceptual fluency is one of the things that would assist in building a better learner.
No, I think there are important questions that are not being asked because these seem to be different domains of research. Now, how do you learn math, and how do your visual system learn to recognize math symbols? Seem to be, like, of course, we said, that's not a problem. Kids can see the symbols and they learn them, and that's not where they seem to get stuck. But there's an interesting question about what you focus on first. It might be a useful strategy to work on the perceptual fluency first, to get students so, you know, familiar and fluent perceiving some of the things that they're going to have to reason about later, such that these things become fun and interesting and attractive, and that you build the sort of spatial relationships that they can see those really quickly, so that, you know, you kind of reduce the challenges that have to be worked on at different levels. So, I mean, that's not what I work on, but I think that there's a future there to ask these questions, to try to, you know, maybe look at a problem, a learning problem, in a different way and say, well, you know, yeah, children can be, or adults, learner, you know, someone learning this problem can get stuck in this way, but maybe if we started them in a different manner, they would take a different learning trajectory and they would not get stuck in that way, because they wouldn't be perceiving the images, the characters in this particular way.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems that there may be some fairly simple ways of enhancing or upgrading your cognitive toolkit, you know, for allowing you to navigate through this learning environment.
Right. Yeah, no, that it would be exciting if we could find demonstrations of, you know, examples where learning an expert skill translate to another domain. And that's hard to do, because often expertise is very specific. So you learn something, and the minute you change something about the images, you can't do it anymore. So it's very hyper-specific. But the other thing you have to be careful about is potential for competitions between domains of expertise. So we've done studies in the lab showing that if you're a car expert and you're a face expert, and we know that the perceptual strategy that you use to learn these two, to perceive objects in these two domains is very similar, then if we put you in a situation where you have to do both at the same time, so you have to, now you're using more holistic processing for cars, well, the holistic processing you have for faces gets reduced. There's competition. It's a common resource. So if you're in a situation where you're learning a lot of different skills, you're acquiring different expertise in different domains, but they require the same perceptual skills, they may compete, and you may do better by reducing that competition. So that would be another kind of translational aspect of the fundamental research that we've been doing.
I talked earlier with Rene, your husband, about the sense that people sense that brains are just these astonishingly fast and powerful computing devices, but actually, if you
would disagree
divide
with that.
Their attention with just two simple tasks, that so the input, being able to take that into a learning situation and talk about multitasking and so on.
I'm sure Rene told you about bottlenecks, right? And the sort of bottlenecks that he's interested in are what I would call domain general bottlenecks. Mm. So they're bottlenecks that are there when you're trying to do two things at once, and it doesn't matter what they are. Those are limits that you have to, limits of attention and executive function and so on. The bottlenecks that I'm interested in are different. They're perceptual bottlenecks, and they're domain-specific bottlenecks. So when you have someone where we find, let's say, competition between face processing and car processing, that's because they use the same perceptual strategy. But if you're a novice and you're looking, a car novice, let's say, and you're looking at faces and cars, they're not going to compete. If you bring in another domain, so you have a car expert now, but you bring in, I don't know, pictures of chairs, those are not going to compete with cars either. So you're getting at levels in the system where competition can be very, very specific to the things you've learned and how you've learned to process them, whereas Renee's interested in these bottlenecks that are fairly fixed. They're not changing that much with experience, and they apply to everything that you do. So it's interesting that you find these similarities at different levels.
In terms of how this applies, are there other areas that you're working in that you think might have some applicability? Or
well, we've been doing some work with colleagues in the Perceptual Expertise Network, like Jim Tanaka and Michael Tarr, on the other race effect. And there really is, a real-world application that's fairly obvious. It would make a difference if you can facilitate the ability that people have to individuate faces of another race. And how do you do that? And, we've been able to do very short training experiments, like 45 minutes, and get an effect that generalizes. So you practice with faces of a race that you're not so familiar with, you learn to individuate faces of this race, and really, no more than 45 minutes, and then we bring in new faces of this race, and you're better at discriminating them.
Yeah.
So that's a very, very quick little training. It has implications. I mean, Mike Tarr in his work has shown that If you do these sorts of trainings, you also can change some of the more semantic and effective prejudices that people have. Would be so, clearly there's value in that sort of work, and we do it for basic reasons to try to understand how the system works. And faces, they're a wonderful case study for expertise because we're really good at them, and everybody can process them, and we know a lot about the brain machinery. But I think in this case, there's really a future for these sorts of short training situations that can again change the way, impact the way that think about people.
Yeah.
And once you start doing that, there's a lot more certainly in law.
Absolutely. So how did you get into this business in the first place? What drove you towards science? Was it a teacher, a book, parents?
It's a series of accidents, I guess. I could have probably done many, many different things and would have been equally happy doing them. So I wanted to be a psychoanalyst at some point in my life and went into a program to do that, and then very quickly realized I didn't want to do that and I didn't really buy into that approach. But I took a class in neuropsychology and read Marta Farah's book, at the time Visual Agnosia, which had just came out, and got a really good grade. And my teacher said, hey, if you want to go to grad school, I'll take you. But then I had a young professor of philosophy who had done a postdoc with Dan Dennett, who, you know, looked me in the eye and said, no, I think you probably want to go to the States. I was in Montreal at the time. And, you know, find some really challenging thing. Like, you basically told me you were very comfortable. Yeah, I was not being challenged very much by that. And I certainly got challenged by the time I got to Yale to grad school. I mean, I was a pretty miserable first-year grad student, but that's what I was looking for, you know, something exciting and challenging that where a lot of work, you know, needed to be done, and I think I found it. So,
what on earth made you, why were you thinking about, that you wanted to be a psychoanalyst?
Gosh, it's so hard to put yourself back in the shoes of the person who wanted to do that.
Well, that's what psychoanalysts do, isn't it?
I know. I guess if I had done the training, I would know now. I was pretty artsy. You know, I used to paint and stuff. So there was that. I had an interest in psychology. I didn't know too much about what psychoanalysis was, except I had read Freud and it was fascinating. And so, you know, I was young and naive. Yeah, interested enough in science that after a couple of classes on this, like, no way, I don't think so. But, you know, it took me where I am, so I embrace it.
So if you hadn't been a scientist, you could conceivably have been a painter, I suppose. From what I know of you and the large Escoffier book sitting on your desk and your liking for cuisine, would you ever consider being a chef or something? Was that another career?
I don't think so. I cook a lot, but I don't think I would have wanted to have a restaurant. I mean, the one chef I'm jealous of is you know, Farhan Adria, because he's more of a scientist than a chef. I wouldn't have wanted to run a restaurant. I think it's a lot harder than to run a lab. No, I think I would have been another kind of scientist, maybe. So I look into physics for a while, and I think I met one scientist at that deciding time who was probably Asperger's or something, convinced me that all physicists were obsessed with the atoms and not in touch with people. And, you know, that would have been a different trajectory if I hadn't met that one person. And I could have been a lawyer, I think, because I like to argue. And my very naive perception of what lawyers do from what I've seen on TV. No, seriously, I think I would have enjoyed that.
You can construct a well-constructed argument as well.
I like that. One of my favorite parts of day-to-day practice of science is writing a rebuttal letter. So that's when your paper, you know, most people really hate that, because that's when your paper just got rejected. And there's something about it to me. It's like, oh, now I know, you know, typically the reviewers are anonymous. You don't know who they are. But you know what they're thinking about your work. And you can do something about it. You can try to convince them, or you can try to get better evidence. But one way or another, it's like, let's work on this and try to convince these people that this is important, useful, and valid. And I really enjoy that. So who knows? I'm not sure in what other domain the skill would have been useful, but it's useful in science. It's very important in science. You know, there are a few skills in science. You have to ask the right question, and you have to design the right experiment that really is valid. But then once you get the wonderful finding that's important, You have to defend it, market it. You know, both in your small little world of experts in this area, you have to explain it, defend it, give it visibility. And then there's, you know, what you allow people to do, which is to reach a broader audience. And all these steps are important. And I think that there's, there's a mistake that some make, that they kind of stop at, oh, well, I made the discovery, so I'm done.
So in the tradition of Peter Medawar's book, I mean, your advice to a young scientist now would be what you just said, I assume, which is be prepared to defend things. Well, what would your advice to a young scientist be? And not that you're old, but...
Yeah, no, I'm not. But I you know, mentoring is one of my, apart from writing rebuttal letters, it would be working with students and postdocs, you know, working with trainees and mentoring them from this naive stage that I recognize, where these people have so much potential, but they're not too sure of themselves, and to a stage where they'll argue with you and they know better. And I enjoy that so much. I think my view of this is that there's not one way, and that the best way of doing that is to kind of observe the student and find what works. So I think the best advice I would have to give to a young scientist is find mentors who are willing to take the time to figure you out. You know, there are scientists who are really focused on doing the research and, again, the discoveries, but that are not so interested in your development as an individual person and scientist and your career and all this. Many are very good at it, but I think you need to find that match because this is an incredibly, incredibly important relationship. You know, it's a craft. It's something that we can't learn, you know, doing science, like many other things, something we can't learn just from books. And there's not one way to train a good scientist. Everybody comes with a very different sets of skills. And, you know, it takes a lot of patience to figure it out. But it's so much fun and so rewarding, so exciting that, you know, so that would be the advice. Find a mentor that's matched to your needs, or at the very least, if you don't know what your needs are yet, you know, find someone who's willing to put the time into the relationship, because it's very demanding.
So you like cooking, you like having dinner parties, you like having people around. I give you carte blanche here to invite anybody from history. Who would you like to have a conversation with? It doesn't have to be one. You can have a whole dinner table.
That's tough. Darwin, of course. Oh, yeah. And Descartes. I think, you know, people like that who are, they get stereotyped so much in what you read about them that you just want to know who the person was. And yeah. And Da Vinci. And, oh, I don't know. There's so many. Yeah, that would be hard. But the food would have to be really good, you know.
And what would you cook?
Oh, I wouldn't cook for that meal. I'd be way too nervous. So I wouldn't cook. Someone else to go to El Bulli and have that dinner.
How do you spell his name again?
Oh, gosh, I'm not even sure I say it properly. It's Ferran Adria, A-D-R-I-A.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember seeing a piece about him somewhere. It was very,
yeah. Always.
Interesting chef, by the sounds of it. So, in his inaugural address, I asked people this question as well. The president said, President Obama said, that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. This is the 350th anniversary year of the foundation of the Royal Society. So we've got this nice, long-running business going on. Science is at a very interesting place in its development right now. So what is its rightful place in society? What is the rightful place of science?
Oh, it's got to be everywhere. Well, it's got to be in the minds of our children. The minute they start asking questions, they need to understand there's a method that allows you to answer these questions. And they need to understand the method that leads to all these discoveries that will impact their lives. I think science education is terrible, and the whole process is a mystery to the majority of people, and yet science has a huge impact on them. And, you know, as a scientist, I think I just I feel sad when science is something that I, as a specialist, do. I would want it to be something. It's like music. You know, music, we know that music, there are people who are great composers and people who are wonderful performers. Those are the experts. But music is for everybody. We can all understand music and enjoy it, and we think it's important and we value it. And science should be like that. It shouldn't be this thing that people do in the ivory tower and then tell us that we should take this pill and not that pill or eat more broccoli. It shouldn't be like that. It should be something that we all value and that we take seriously as the best way to figure out how things work and make decisions. You know, so more clearly oppose it to other ways of thinking that can ask similar questions, but in a way. So, yeah, I think it should be everywhere. Mm. That's its rightful place.
What are you optimistic about?
Everything.
Oh, you characterize yourself as one of the world's happiest people, right?
No, I said I'm pathologically happy.
Pathologically
yeah,
happy.
Yeah, it's a disease. So I'm optimistic about everything. I can't help it.
Okay.
So, yeah, I know. That's just the truth.
Well, it's been fun talking to you.
Well, thank you.
Isabel Gautier, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.